to Juno Afternoon. It is Friday, December 30th, and this is the last show of the year. Today, we're looking back on some of our favorite interviews from 2022. We'll hear host Andy Klein's conversation with Nick Jans as they share the history of and memories about Romeo the Wolf. Rhonda McBride chats with members of the Aurora Strings as they discuss their performance at Carnegie Hall. And finally, we'll listen to my interview with Jim Powell about the Juno Climate Report released earlier this year. Those conversations, music, and more coming up right here on Juno Afternoon. KTOO Public Media would like to acknowledge the Xinedi of the Ak Kwan. We are on their ancestral homeland. Our broadcast studios are built on fill that was once tideland and part of what is called the Indian Village. We recognize those families who traveled to and from their homes from these tidelands to fishing and hunting grounds and to gatherings in other villages, whose children played on the beaches and learned to row in the harbor, and who have never relinquished their property rights and hunting and fishing rights, nor their ownership and stewardship of their land and waterways. The families of the Juno Indian Village, like their ancestors, cherish and depend upon their immediate connection to the waterfront. KTOO is working to lift up Thlinkit voices through the sharing of stories like these and the broadcast of the Thlinkit language. Please excuse us for our mistakes, and gunas cheese for your patience as we learn. You are listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm Shelley Delaney. On today's show, we're looking back on the best of Juno Afternoon for 2022. This past year, there was a big focus on remembering Juno's favorite lone wolf, Romeo. Romeo is a household name, but it's been 18 years since he last graced our trails. In February of this year, Andy Klein talked with Nick Jans, author of A Wolf Called Romeo. In this conversation, they shared both the history as well as their memories of Romeo the Wolf.
You're listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm Andy Klein. Not everyone can say that they've had a relationship with a wolf, let alone write a book about it. But when Nick Jans wrote A Wolf Called Romeo, he wanted to tell the story of not just any wolf, but one that Juno skiers and hikers came to know and love. Nick, thanks so much for joining us. Nick, you're down in Florida today. Appreciate you zooming in with us.
Yeah, well, I was supposed to be there, but it was one of those things that mean old Mr. Virus just kind of dictates to you.
That's right. Well, Nick, I remember Romeo so well, had some really amazing experiences with him, just seeing him from a distance there on Mendenhall right. Lake, taking my dog, making sure I was keeping my dog on a leash, even though she was very interested in Romeo. But I think that we might be getting to the point where there's a lot of people that don't remember a firsthand experience with Romeo. And I'm wondering what your perspective is there as you're going to give a fireside lecture talk about that.
Well, you know, that's the thing, is that history has a way of creeping up on you. You know, that's something that seems like something that was every day. I mean, to my mom and dad, World War II was something they went through.
That's right. Yeah.
And to us, it's in somewhere way back in the rearview mirror, let alone Vietnam, you know. And something like this wolf was such a unique experience. It was pretty much unheard of. I mean, it's one of the great wild animal human interactions of all recorded history. You know, really, I mean, that sounds pretty hyperbolic, but if you leave out the stuff that isn't documented, there just isn't a case of a wolf and a community being on good terms with each other.
It was quite amazing, and it was the talk of the town when it was happening. Remind us the period of time this was happening. How many years was it, and from what year to what year about?
It's hard to believe, but it was 2003 to 2008. So that means it was 18 years since we first saw that wolf.
Wow, yeah.
Give or take.
And just a 5-year period when that phenomena was happening.
Actually, it's about 6. Mm-hmm. And some people say it's a little bit longer because there was a time when there were rumors circulating about a wolf out by the glacier and down in the wetlands and so on. But it started getting nailed down in November of 2003, October, November 2003. And as the lake froze, he started appearing more and more out on the lake.
Yeah, now it was a winter phenomena, right? That's how I remember it.
It was for most people, but the wolf came down and used the wetlands areas there surrounding the lake when it was frozen. And of course, when it's all boggy, he was still around some of the time. And he definitely went up into the high country a little more. But there were people like, for instance, Harry Robinson, who will tell you that he had contact with that wolf during the summer and into the fall. And most people just saw him when he came down the lake. And he would disappear even during the winter, sometimes for days, weeks, or even more at a time. And every time he was gone, I thought, well, there he's gone, just going back to being a wolf. Or I think terrible thoughts about what might have happened to him. And then he appeared again, mm-hmm. and he kept coming back, and he kept coming back, and he kept rising from the dead,
yeah,
as it were.
Let's recap a little bit some of the, you know, what are the reasonings? What are some of the theories about why he appeared in the first place? Why he was there alone, and then kind of the ideas behind why the relationship between the community and him progressed.
Okay, well, first part is that we will never know how exactly that wolf came to be, but there are a number of people who have said things with great certainty that they can't be really certain about. But we do know this, is that a female pregnant black wolf got hit by a taxi out in Back Loop Road in 2003, and he stopped, and he heard wolves howling. It was out near the bridge, and he heard wolves howling, and it was thereafter that this one wolf appeared. And some people say that he was her mate. I don't really buy that. I think it's certainly a romantic notion,
isn't it? And
it could have been, but he was a young guy, and not too many adolescent wolves have a wife and family any more than too many 16-year-olds do. Sure, it's biologically possible. So anyway, that's one possibility. But one thing I think is that very, very likely is that he was a sibling or some sort of a relative of that pack. And for whatever reason, the others moved off, the survivors moved off, and he decided to stay around. That much is pretty much, you know, I would say he was connected to that female wolf. But the reason for people kind of getting attached to him, who knows? Okay.
A wolf acting in that way, tolerating people,
sure.
The curiosity. Usually wolves, of course, are so much wanting to get away from where people are.
Usually all you see is this furry butthole disappearing up over the hill. You know, if you catch a glimpse of a wolf,
right.
It's going away fast.
Yeah.
And it was, at first, people were pretty tenuous, and it was a pretty well-kept secret out there among a few, and everyone thought they were keeping a secret from everybody else.
Right.
They said, hey, I got something to tell you. There's a wolf out there. I said, oh, I was going to tell you. And it went from there. So he grew, though, into being quite a celebrity, because once you have a 100-and-some-odd-pound black wolf out on an open lake wanting to socialize with people's dogs, and that's what he came for, is he came for our dogs. He wanted social contact. And that put him in touch with us inevitably. And that's what I think is really remarkable about this story, is that it traces that conflicted, convoluted relationship between man's best friend, man's greatest fear, and us.
Yeah.
And that connection.
Is that what drew you to the story? What was it that drew you to the point where you actually wrote a book about it and really began studying this? And what was it that brought you in?
Well, first of all, I was a firsthand direct participant in the whole thing. The name Romeo came from my wife, Sherry. I mean, I lived out by the glacier, the last house there before Skater's Cabin. I built it and didn't know that I was doing that, so I would meet this wolf. And I came to Alaska in 1979 to be a wolf and bear biologist. I didn't end up doing that. I ended up living in Inupiaq villages in the far north, and traveling with Inupiaq hunters and seeing wolves on my own out in the surrounding country. By the time I came south, got married to Sherry, I'd encountered many dozens of wolves. I can't even count them, singly, in pairs, in great packs, from a distance, close up. And I thought I was leaving that all behind. I came down to Juneau. Oh, I'm living with Fred Meyer up the road. And oh, there's a road. And lo and behold, there's a wolf literally at my doorstep. You know, the old saying, a wolf at the door, was a literal thing for 6 years on and off of my life out there. And so I had a direct personal engagement. He was waiting out there for our dogs and, you know, to come out and do what they had to do sooner or later, because he wanted to socialize. And my wife, Sherry, gave him the name Romeo because he seemed so attracted to our beautiful yellow lab, Dakota. And of course, that's her picture on the book cover there. But he had relationships with a number of dogs. And it was just the way that you and I have friendships and relationships. Some are closer, some are less close. Some people we're really drawn to, and we don't know exactly why. Sometimes we do. But there certainly was all variations, including where he had frenemies and even enemies among dogs.
There was observed different behaviors with different specific individual dogs. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there were dogs that irked him. There were dogs that attacked him. I think of these two large German Shepherd dogs that he was having social contact with. And one of them suddenly turned on him and grabbed him by the back. And he was totally caught by surprise. And he had a wound on his back that was very visible for a year there, and then a scar after that. And that was from him being attacked, and he did nothing to those dogs. He had everything from dogs, like for instance, my neighbors, Tim and Maureen Hall's rabbity little border collie named Jessie. She'd run off this little, 25-pound dog and disappear with this wolf and be gone, you know, for hours and hours, and would come back. You know,
yeah.
And I saw some a big chunky golden retriever talking some smack to him once, and Romeo hooked his nose underneath that dog's chin and just gave a toss of his head, and that dog did a flip in the air and came down on his keister, and he just looked at the dog, stood over it, and walked off.
Well, I mean, it is amazing, and one of the things I remember so distinctly seeing Romeo was there's no mistaking a wolf. I mean, it, you know, it's not like, oh, there's a dog. It's not, there's nothing like that. It's they're massive, intimidating, tall, lanky. They're a whole other type of creature than those of us that might think, oh, I was scared. I saw a German Shepherd on the trail and I thought it was a wolf.
Right. Right.
You know, it's a whole other thing.
Absolutely. It's like mistaking a Shetland pony for Seabiscuit, you know. It's kind of the same general shape and everything, but no. A wolf is an uber dog. You know, it's bigger, faster, stronger, smarter, everything in this package. And then we get a hold of that wolf, that wolf genome, that lupine genome. And what do? We dumb it down. We make it smaller and easier to handle and fool it into thinking that it's got a good deal with us, which actually
it probably does.
Well, actually it does.
Yeah,
actually it does. And not to make light of anything, because I'm very much a dog lover, but you have to remember that even a teacup chihuahua is 90 something percent genetically identical to a wolf. And it's really amazing that we started off with wolves and we ended up with what we have. But Romeo is sort of that link between those two. And he is just a single example. This, the wolf that came to lie by our fire, must not have happened once, but many times throughout human history for us to have this great arising of dogs all over. Wherever we were, we had dogs going back 30,000 plus years, and that is part of the archaeological record.
Yeah, it's fascinating to think about that. And did the interactions between Romeo that you observed or were part of, did it give you a hint about that a little bit, about those first things that we'll probably never quite know fully, but how dogs became part of our lives?
Well, it more impressed on me over and over again the miracle that it happened at all. I mean, this is one of the probably the single most unique bond between two different species on the planet. And by the way, you have to remember that dogs and wolves are technically the same species, according to North American Society of Mammalists.
Yeah, they can
different branches and, for sure.
Right.
Yeah. They can have viable offspring. So, of course, they're the same species technically, and somehow we have this alliance, and I think there always was this thing between wolves and us as apex predators, and yet at the same time, we saw them as, obviously, as competition, because ever since the rise of civilization, we've been in the business of killing off wolves. We're talking about worldwide, and you can say, oh, no, well, you know, I love wolves and that. Now, if you just look at the whole thing, every place you put up a parking lot or a road or a farm field, there isn't space, or certainly not a pasture full of sheep. There is no space there for a wolf.
And certainly wolves have been vilified as, you know, the bad guy in countless fables and stories throughout human history. So, yeah, you're right. There's a long history of us. While we did domesticate wolves and they're partners with us, and probably in the early stages they weren't very different than wild wolves, they just had gotten used to us. We definitely also have this it's a love-hate relationship, and that sort of goes down to this idea of Romeo. You know, one thing I wanted to ask you, Nick, is that your book A Wolf Called Romeo is going to be used in the Battle of the Book competition in Juneau. What do you think about this? That's an important book for maybe younger people to be reading.
Well, I'm just incredibly honored that it was chosen, first of all. But I realized that those kids, if they were 15 years old, they were toddlers at best.
Right.
And I'll probably be talking to some kids who weren't even born yet, or right around that time, or were maybe six years old, 5 years old. And this is part of Juno's story. And it's an incredible part of Juno's story. And you think about the fact that here we are having this series of events, which, by the way, I have to say is all due to composer Todd Hunt. It is totally his deal. He started this ball rolling. And that in itself is just so cool, and it's such an honor to Romeo's memory that he is still alive among us. You can go out to the glacier, and there is that bronze plaque on the way to the waterfall, and there he is. And yeah, you know, I know it's taxidermy, but it's what we had left of him. And there he is inside the visitor center.
Yeah, and that's something actually to cover that maybe people aren't aware of, but Romeo is there. That is Romeo. That is what we had left of him to recover, that's there in the visitor center.
Yeah, and not only that, that's one of the stories that tour bus operators and people on cruise ships, me included, tell people from somewhere else, because it is such a quintessential Alaska story. This is all about what people think should happen in Alaska. And one of the first things I have to do is offer them a disclaimer is, no, this sort of thing doesn't happen, not even in Alaska. And yet it did.
That was Andy Klein talking with Nick Jans. If you'd like to see the Fireside Talk featuring Jans, visit the Mendenhall Glacier Center's Facebook page and click on More, then Videos. Coming up next, we'll go back to this past May when Rhonda McBride invited members of the Juno Strings Ensemble to the studio to share their plans to perform at Carnegie Hall and play some live music. You're listening to Juno Afternoon.
Hanson Gress. Ka eat with the shoe ye, we kashuk a ye tin. Jin kat ka ke jin ta kanakaya ha anikak gunish cheese.
Are listening to some of the students in the Juno Strings Ensemble from the Aurora Strings Group. Gunnish Cheesh for being here with us today. This is Juno Afternoon, and I'm Rhonda McBride. Let's listen a little more and come back and hear the story behind how these students will soon be on the stage at Carnegie Hall. Boy, that was lovely, and we're going to hear a little more. That was Carice Hudson playing first cello and Elizabeth Jaja Lee on first violin, two of the members of the group, and we're going to hear a little more for them. But we have two other members with us, and I thought I'd like to go around the room and have them introduce themselves, tell us how long they've played and what part they play in the orchestra. So I'm going to begin with you, Alex. And also maybe just play a little so we can hear what you sound like.
Hello, my name is Alex Yu, or Alexander Yu, and I'm the concertmaster of the Juno String Ensemble. And I've been playing for 14 years, since I was four, and I started with Mr. Shaw.
So let's hear a little. Wow. You can tell you've been playing since you were 4 years old. I'm sure there are a lot of hours of practice there. So let's go to Tobin Montalbo, who is on first cello. Tell us a little bit about yourself and let us hear what you've accomplished.
Hi, I'm Tobin Montalbo. I've been playing for about 8 years. I started in sixth grade. I really like working with the group, and it's been probably the best thing in my entire music career has been getting selected to go to Carnegie, so I'm super excited.
And we'll hear more about that in a moment. I want to go to Elizabeth Jaja Lee, who is the first violinist. Tell us a little bit about how long you've been playing.
Hi, my name is Elizabeth Jaja Lee, and I've been playing violin for 12 years, also since I was four. And yeah, it's a great honor to be going to Carnegie Hall. It's amazing.
I can hear the excitement in your voices about this. Thank you. Oh, wow. That's beautiful. So I want to go next to Karis Hudson. She's the first cello player. So we have two cello players in this room.
Hi, I'm Karis Hudson, and I've been playing cello for about 6 years. I started in third grade, and I joined Shaw's music group in about, I think, sixth grade. And here's a snippet.
You know, and we missed Tobin. Forgot to ask him to play. So, Tobin, let's hear a little bit from you. Well, we will talk about Carnegie in a moment, but I'm just curious because the Juno Jazz and Classics Festival comes to this town, and of course they go to the schools and everything, and of course the head of the now the artistic director for Juno Jazz and Classics is one of the most world known cello players, Zool Bailey. So, Tobin, what's that like to be in a community where you can have access to people like him?
It's super cool. Just having the Jack right there downtown and Centennial Hall and all the things that they host, like Folk Fest, being in a community like Juno where music is so important really makes it a lot easier and a lot more exciting to grow up also playing music because you get to see these great players to that like are really all the way around to inspire you. So I really enjoy growing up here and playing music here.
So how about you, Karis?
Oh, definitely, yeah. I got to play with the Ariana String Quartet, and the cellist in that group, he mentored me and he helped me, like, learn more things about my cello and how to play better. Like, it's great. Juno has one of the best music communities I've seen.
I want to go to you, Elizabeth, the first violinist for the Aurora Strings. How did you guys get to the point that you were invited to come to play to Carnegie? Did you have to earn that opportunity somehow?
Yeah, so a lot of us have been playing with this group for a really long time, for about at least a couple of years, and then we did an audition process during the pandemic where we sent in pieces, and we were one of only four groups chosen around the globe to play at Carnegie Hall, so we're all really proud of that.
Oh, my goodness. So what does that mean, Tobin, for a group from such a small community? What does that say?
I mean, it's a pretty crazy experience. Carnegie Hall is probably the most famous music hall in all of North America. So being from a town like Juneau of just 30,000 people, going down to New York and playing at this huge music hall is a super big honor. And we just want to carry what we've learned here and really show off that smaller towns have great musicians too. And it's super exciting.
But, and Juno is not just any small town, given the music culture here. And I'd like you to talk a little bit about your director. Alex, since you're kind of the concert master, you know, what's your impression of Mr. Shaw? Tell us a little bit about him.
So Mr. Shaw is well-known in the music community because of what he's done and all he's done for us. And he's very passionate about his students and about the performance, and he'll schedule multiple performances for us so we can show off to the community.
Yeah, Mr. Shaw is like one of the most patient people. Alex and I have been studying with him for over 10 years, and we've never seen him get angry. And he's just, and everything he does with us is always just so energetic and so lively, and he schedules everything for us, and he puts in so much time for his students.
So give me his first name, because I think I see that on a page, and I'm afraid to say it.
Yeah, for sure. His first name is Gua Hua.
Gua Hua.
Yeah, Gua Hua Shaw.
And what's his story?
So Mr. Shaw, he studied in the Shanghai Conservatory, which is one of the most probably the most prestigious in like all of China. And then he came here, and he's been teaching in Juneau's small town community for over 25 years. And now he teaches us, so this is great.
So would any of you care to talk about some of the lessons you've learned from being around Mr. Shaw?
Being around Shaw, I mean, he makes me excited for practice every single time that we have it. He, you can just really tell how much he loves music. He tunes all our instruments by ear. He's just He is super passionate, probably the most passionate player that I've ever seen. And it is super inspiring. So he makes me want to be a better player, and he's the kind of conductor that makes me want to go out and practice more and become as good as I possibly can. And then going to New York with him is going to be so amazing, because I'm so happy that he gets to be up there too with us and just share that whole experience with us.
I imagine that he must be excited, that this must be a dream come true, because is this the first Juno ensemble strings group to go to Carnegie?
Yeah, it was the first Juno string ensemble time for going to Carnegie Hall, but I think his groups have been to other places before.
Yeah, his groups have gone to Shanghai, gone to play the Great Wall, yeah.
During COVID, there was a lot of worry about whether this would happen or not, but I don't think he ever lost faith, and that really helped us all stay motivated too. So we kept practicing and we kept performing, and now we're here, and it's confirmed, and we leave very soon, and it's super exciting.
So Alex, tell us a little bit about your role as concert master. What does that involve?
So as concert master, I lead the group. I'm basically the second conductor, and I would help lead the section, cue them in, do the things that Mr. Shaw or the conductor wouldn't do, but I'm like the backup person.
You're the backup. So what have you learned from Mr. Shaw about leadership?
Listening in and knowing about everything, knowing about what is going on in the orchestra, and yeah.
So he's super tuned in to you guys.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think we'll talk a little bit more about how you guys got to Carnegie. You know, beyond the competition, there's much more involved. But first, Karis and Elizabeth, would you play us a little more and tell us what you're going to play for us?
Yeah, so we'll be playing the second half of Air from Suite in D by Johann Sebastian Bach.
And so you performed this together somewhere else, correct?
Yeah, so we actually played a different piece called Passacaglia by Handel Halvorsen at the Great Alaska Talent Show earlier this in March. So, Carol's
yeah, that was a great opportunity. We got to play. We were the only people from Juno playing with going against a bunch of people from Anchorage. And although we didn't win, it was a great opportunity to play.
I think every chance you get to play and perform makes you stronger, doesn't it? It
yeah,
steals you for the next experience. Okay, well, let's listen. I'm excited to hear. That was absolutely beautiful. What a treat to sit here in the Carolyn Hobbs Peterson Studio 2K of KTOO. Carolyn Hobbs Peterson is who the studio was named for, and I think she's on the wall behind us there, and I'm sure she would have been delighted to hear this beautiful music. You know, I'm sure that you guys have had to practice a lot to do this, but there have been many other people involved in getting you to Carnegie. Tobin, can you talk about the fundraising efforts? Because you know, how many people are in the orchestra, and how do you raise money for travel for that?
So, yeah, New York is a long way away. So fundraising got kind of squashed a little bit because of COVID. Normally we do a lot more concerts where you'd buy tickets, and that's a really great way for us to get profits. But because of COVID, it was harder to do that. So everyone took a lot more individual responsibility for fundraising. I know that me and my mom went around to a bunch of different businesses downtown and got money from them, and they sponsored us, and they're on the back of our T-shirts that we'll be wearing in one of our two performances down in New York. We also talked to probably 50 family friends, and the great thing about Juno, again, is that everyone is so supportive, so the vast majority of people we talked to were completely willing to donate from anywhere to 20 to 100 or more. And it was just great seeing how excited people were for us to be able to go there. And knowing that all these people helped us get to Carnegie is really motivating to just make it the best performance of our entire lives.
Thank you, Tobin. Karis, any thoughts on that?
Definitely what Tobin was saying. Like, almost all of us contacted as many family, friends, and just people in the community, and all of them were willing to help out. Especially, like, we had this online-funded thing on Facebook where people would donate, like, as much as, $200 or $500. I know one person got donated $1,000 from someone in the community, which is amazing. To be able to play cello in the same place as Yo-Yo Ma and some of the greatest musicians ever lived, it's incredible. And I'll get to tell everyone, my kids, my family, whoever, like, that this is one of the greatest experiences I've had.
Yeah, I think us going to Carnegie College just shows that all that practice, all that hard work, it always pays off. And then, you know, practice makes perfect. But, and then how do you get to Carnegie Hall? It's always like practice, work together, listen to each other. And, you know, we made it.
So there's a lot of hard work going into this. And you're juggling your schoolwork and all that other stuff in the mix. So, Alex, as concertmaster, what are some of the challenges that the group is going to have with some of the pieces of music?
Some challenges are the younger players in our group. Some of the pieces are quite the reach for them, but since we've been practicing the same music for a long time, it should be in their muscle memory and they should be able to play it.
So, Tobin, I mean, you probably have encountered that often, that you start off with a piece of music that seems way out of reach, and you think, oh my God, I'll never be able to play that. What's it like when you reach the point that you can play that piece of music?
It's definitely very satisfying being able to show up to practice and then and have concerts that consistently sound good. And we're just every single concert we've had over the past year has been getting better. And like Alex said, we had to bring up some of the younger kids from the smaller groups to make sure that we had enough people to actually play, because there is a minimum size requirement. But they've all really stepped up, and everyone is capable of playing all the music that we have. So I'm super confident in this group, and we've all come together really well to be able to play the songs very well.
So, Elizabeth, tell us about some of the pieces of music you're working on to perform.
Yeah, so some of our pieces, we have a range of pieces from Haydn or to Hoedown and then rhythm dances. So we have like a variety. We have some fast pieces, some slow pieces, and we always pick the pieces that we think our audience will connect with. And then we think that applies whether here in our community or in New York City.
So, Karis, do you have any favorite pieces?
I definitely say Rhythm Dances by, I'm not sure who it is by, and then Hoedown by Copeland, which is a great, everyone gets into it, and they're, like, very lively, because it's really fast, so I'm, like, tapping my foot and, like, humming along.
So tell us what you're going to play for us going out.
We'll be playing Jupiter from the Planets by Holst.
Okay, and I just once again want to go through everyone who is here today. Alex Yu, who is a concertmaster, a first violinist, and Tobin Montalbo, first cello. And we also have Karis Hudson, who is on cello, and Elizabeth Jaja Lee, first violin. Thank you.
That was Rhonda McBride speaking with members of the Juno Strings Ensemble. Their conversation first aired on May 19th. This is the Best of Juno Afternoon. Next up, we'll hear my interview with Jim Powell about the new Juno Climate Report. You're listening to Juno Afternoon.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
You're listening to Juno Afternoon. Today, we're looking back on some of our favorite interviews from 2022. In July of this year, the Alaska Coastal Rainforest Center released a report on Juno's changing climate. Up next, I talk with Jim Powell, one of the authors on this project. Here with me now is Jim Powell, project coordinator and lead editor for this report. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, thanks for being here today. There's so much to talk about with this report, but I thought maybe we'd just start with an overview for folks who haven't seen it yet, don't know what it is, didn't know it was coming. How did it come to be, and how long has this been in the works?
Sure, yeah. Well, there's quite a history to this. In 2007, the mayor at the time, former mayor Bruce Botello, and the dean at the university, Brendan Kelly, said, you know, we've got to start thinking about this climate change here. And that was in 2007. And then they said, well, let's put together a report. And that's what Bruce wanted. So he went to the university. He said, get your best and brightest, put them together, and put together a report on the impacts of climate change in Juno. That was hard to do because you have these global models, but you have to downscale those. And that's a lot of work, that's a lot of computation, and we don't have a lot of track record information. Alaska generally doesn't have a lot of information. So the scientists, you know, since 1940s, you know, we've got information about precipitation at the airport, but, you know, we're still creating a lot of information. So back then, that was a new report. That was almost unique that a small community, that a local community would downscale some of that information. So that was cool. So we got it out, we put together people together, and then 15 years later, here we are. So our targets for this were, and I think we're hitting the target so far, is that it's for the general public. So we had to keep it, you know, in good, I don't want to say simple language, but not highly technical language.
Yeah.
And yet we still wanted information for scientists to reference, because there's a lot of the pages in the back are references, and then decision makers. So how do you do that? So we put the history in the front, and then we created 9 key messages. 7 of those messages are ecological, they're science-based, and 2 of them really go to policy and what is Juno doing? And I thought that would be a key message, because it is a key message. Back in 2007, we weren't doing a lot. Now we're doing a lot for a small community. We have NGOs. We have 3 NGOs that are working on climate change. And more than that, I mean, almost every agency, every organization thinks about climate change. And then into the report, we have adaptation and mitigation. What are we doing? So there's really three sections of the report, and that wasn't in the old report. So I think that's an improvement, and I think it looks really good. I'm really happy with the layout, and that it's really pleasing. It's something you'd pick up and want to read.
Just in the first few pages, there's a message from Ray Paddock, who represents the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska, and it's sort of a response, or it talks about their climate change adaptation plan as a response to changes that they've seen on their land and with their food and their resources. So how does this report support their efforts, or how are you guys working with Central Council in your research efforts?
One of the first things I did was call Ray, and I've been working with him on other projects. And I said, hey, we want to do this climate change report. He says, well, we just came out with one. Mm-hmm. You know, it's adaptation report. I said, great. I said, do we want to, you know, put it together as one report? And we said, no, because theirs really is based upon traditional and ecological knowledge as well as scientific knowledge. So their basis of their assumptions and everything are very different. And it was a regional report because it's for Tlingit Haida. So we thought, well, let's highlight at the beginning of the report so people know it's there and can go directly to it. So that was what the thinking was.
And there's quite a bit as well of, I saw there's some Tlingit language in the report as well. Some place names were used.
The authors really brought a lot of different perspectives. And one author Richard Carsten, he said, make sure you put as much, you know, native language as you can. I thought, oh, okay, I can. We could have done a lot more. I wish I could have done a lot more, but in our time limitations, that's the best we could do, but we tried.
Well, I'm sure you'll have the opportunity to update this report or put out another one here in the next couple of years. As you mentioned, it outlines 9 major takeaways. I know they are all of high importance, but are there a couple that are of immediate concern that you might want to talk about today?
I think the one that one of the newer ones here, landslides, because it's visible, it's new, and it's something maybe we can control, or not control, but to manage. You know, there's going to be flashy floods. We're going to have more precip, as we know, warmer temperatures, which all drive this. But I think that's an important one, an important message. And people know about it. They can see it. In local government, where I used to work for 9 years on the assembly, local government is really important right now because it's not polarized. It's by design nonpartisan. So we get things done. We have to. It's very accountable. And that's one of the things you see. So I think that you'll see some things in that area, and we have a section in this report on that. So I think that was really important. All of them are really important to monitor and to watch and see how things play out. We can't really, if you pick one, it's hard to do because it's so ubiquitous. There are going to be surprises, which we don't know. If you ask scientists, they'll say, well, we have some indicators. We have some trend information. But to tell you exactly what's going to happen in the future, we can't do that. But we have some good trend information that we can try to work on right now.
Well, how well equipped do you think we are to keep people safe from landslides right now? What's been done and what needs to be done?
That's a very hard thing to... I think there's a lot that's been done. We have mass wasting zones, and now in the report it talks to this. I think we're doing a lot. I know that they're planning more. I mean, you have to do more engineering. You have to do more planning and thinking about it. It brings back, I can't not talk about this. And when I was on the assembly in the 90s and 2000s, we had similar concerns about those zones. They weren't as dramatic as now, but we had concerns about, well, do we put it on maps? You know, and then it gets into private property and all these other complicated issues. So we have that. There's a policy issue, but then there's the science issue. And we can speak to the science, and we can start building that up more and more and more as we know more. So I think that's going to help inform those policy decisions that have to be made at the City Hall. So I think that this helps. And this report, again, is just built upon, we say, built upon the shoulders of others. And that's what's really important about the report. It's a moment in time. It's what we know right now, and we're building upon that, and maybe we can make better decisions. So my hope is that the City Assembly will use the report, the information in it, to be better informed, to make better decisions. And that's a key issue that needs to be responded to in Juneau now, and in Southeast, as we saw in Haines and Sitka. Very important.
Putting landslide zones on maps,
right? And doing the hard work. People, it's hard because we always want the answer, but we need to go back and figure out, okay, the particulars about it, the science. To get to the answer, we have to slow down, back up, look at the science, and then make the decision.
Well, in addition to landslides, floods are another threat to life and property. Can you talk a little bit about the status of storm drains in CBJ?
I can't. I wish I could. But I think that what I've heard so far, I'm not an expert in that area, but I think that, you know, the community was engineered with the best knowledge we had for what size of a culvert do you have. And it was based upon science then. We have to redesign that. And we have to think about the engineering that was done and now what is the new engineering rather than 100-year flood zones and events. Those events are occurring more often. So it's important to look at that data right now and go, maybe we should be redesigning things around. And I think that comes. And that's engineering, not science. But I think that it's time to look at the engineering based upon the new science.
And the new science is saying that these 100-year events, these 20-year events are going to be
occurring more often
and be bigger.
Could be flashier, you know, more events.
Yeah. I want to shift again. There's so much talk about the impact of cruise ships, and this report states that they are, in fact, a major source of air pollution, but that dock electrification may be a solution to that. So how far is there to go based on your research?
Yeah, that's an interesting, that's a very interesting topic. It's one that I've been doing research on. In fact, I have a National Science Foundation grant to compare Juneau with four other places in the Arctic that are cruise locations. And that's one issue. For example, in Bjørgen, Norway, which I just got back from 3 weeks ago, they're going in some of their fjords, no emissions at all. Zones.
Wow.
Zero. That's something. That's really something.
Yeah.
In Juneau, we've moved forward. You know, we had the first plug-in ship in the world, which we can be very proud
of. It's very cool.
Yeah, very, very cool. So I think it was last Friday that I was with a group, Kirby Day and others from the city and some assembly members. We looked at we actually saw them plug up, you know, plug
nice.
In, I should say. And we talked about the future. And I know that some of the things discussed were the next, where are we going to do it next? Because some of I think the big thing that needs to be now is that the Visitor Industry Working Group, which came out with recommendations 2 years ago before COVID hit, and they had a lot of good recommendations. I thought it was very, very good recommendations. One was there was a limitation on the number of cruise ships, and that's what we put in here, to turn up the volume on those recommendations, really.
Yeah.
We referenced those because we thought they were good. So one was to limit the number of cruise ships. The other one was to have all plug-in, you know, docks. So I know that in the plans or somewhere in the plans right now, the city docks, too, there would be two more plug-ins. Very expensive. You do anything on the dock, it is not just hundreds of thousands, it's millions of dollars because it's very stout and it's very big and very expensive. So I know that is in the works for another two, and eventually we'll have them all plugged in. And I know that ships themselves are going to different fuels, and the International Maritime Organization, the IMO, which is the international governing body, if you can say governing, has recommended different fuels, and they have goals too. So it's not just us in Juneau. There is an international perspective and directive of cruise ships, which is only 2% of the ships that are out there. It's a small percentage, but it's a percentage, to change your fuels that are better and actually go towards lower impact. Because one ship has a heck of a lot of pollutants compared to what we do in a car.
Mm-hmm.
So let's look at that. There's another thing about climate change that we need to consider when we're looking at a climate change report. What are our bounds? Do we want to talk about cruise ships? They're here and they go. Are they beyond our bounds? I don't think they are. I think that we use them, we benefit from them, they're part of our community. So they should be part of the calculus when we do our greenhouse gas emissions. What about the mines that we have? I mean, they're part of our community, so they should be part of that calculus of what's our greenhouse gas number for a community. So that all needs to be considered. That's why that was in a report, and the emissions is big enough to be considered, and it's something we can do something about as a city.
So much more to talk about, Jim. I could honestly keep you here for another 20 minutes. We
That's
do need
fun.
To wrap
yeah.
up, though. So the only the last thing I wanted to ask you about were the images in the report, because they, as you mentioned, like the layout, the design, it's so readable. The images are as important as the text. There's graphs, there's photos, and there's even like computer-generated images of the future. So do you want to talk a little bit about how the imagery supports the report?
Well, it was a balance. I mean, it was really difficult to ask a scientist, can you tell me about your research in a paragraph and make sure it doesn't use too many references and technical information? That was hard. But I have to give a lot of credit to Molly Tankersley, because she really did a great job of putting it together. And that was the point, is that pictures tell 1,000 words, and we didn't want to crowd it too much like a like reports that I read, or I mean that I read and that I produce in articles, because people won't pick it up. And especially the 9 messages I thought was important. As a former assembly member, I want to know what the message is. So I think that was important. Yeah, I think the graphics are really, really good. You can look at just the graphics and get a heck of a story.
It's true. They all seem like, I mean, there's nothing extraneous there. Every image has a meaning and belongs there. It's not just there for decoration.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. They all are referenced in the, you know, in the text. They all mean something, for sure. Yeah, and I should thank the 22 other authors. They did a great job in hanging in there through the 2 years and back and forth and everything else that happens in a production like this.
That was my interview with Jim Powell, which first aired on July 13th, 2022. The full Juno Climate Report is available online at acrc.alaska.edu. Gnashchish for listening today to Juno Afternoon and for listening all year round. That's a wrap on 2022. Juno Afternoon will be on break for the first week of January, but we will return with new episodes on Wednesday, January 11th. Support for Juno Afternoon is provided by Hanson Gress, Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, and Clinkett and Haida Social Enterprises. Our theme music is by Indian Agent. If you'd like more information about today's show or you'd like to be on the show yourself, please check out our website at ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon. Have a great Juno evening and a happy Juno New Year here on Tlingit Ani.